listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Gregory Crutzen. Gregory, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I want to start talking a little bit about your undergraduate beginnings, and I know you studied with Jan Groover. Can you tell me a little bit about how her thinking, style, work influenced your own?
Well, firstly, I'll say that I came to SUNY Purchase originally wanting to follow in my father's footsteps and study psychology. My father was a psychoanalyst. And I always struggled with dyslexia. Academia was always very difficult for me. So I just remember my initial sort of first 2 years there was a real struggle, and it wasn't until I actually had a crush on a girl who was a photography major. You might remember her, Chris Schiavo. Does that name strike a...
Yeah.
And I followed her into the undergraduate department and took a photography class. And that was my first contact with photography, really. But as soon as I made my first picture, I had this profound understanding that that photography was the thing I was going to do. And I think it had something to do with the fact that it's these frozen and mute moments in time that made complete sense to me in a way that other things didn't. And I think that's because I could comprehend things.
How did that relate to what Jan Groover was teaching? I mean, that's a big leap for you. You were there essentially academically, not for, even though you were in an art school. Is there a connection between your initial studies and that?
Well, my first teacher was Laurie Simmons, who was extraordinary. I'm still very close with her. But when I took my first classes with Jan Groover, it was a profound transformation. She was absolutely intense and rigorous, and I remember her very well doing her full day crits. She would line 7 cups of coffee at this long table and smoke 2 packs of cigarettes throughout the day and talk about the pictures. And
smoking wasn't allowed in the classroom then.
Right, then, but it didn't stop her. And she did have this amazing effect on me in terms of, I think, the formal issues in photography. We became very close.
And after school, what happened? So now you graduated, your photography is your medium.
Right.
That's how it felt upon graduating. Then what was next? When did you have your first show?
Well, not for some time. When I graduated SUNY Purchase, well, one thing I did when I was at SUNY Purchase was I took an internship at Daniel Wolf Gallery. And the main reason I did that was I wanted to meet Joel Sternfeld, who was like a photographer that I loved and admired. But the year I left, I wound up taking another internship at Aperture and studied and worked there for a year. And then I applied to graduate schools, and I wound up being accepted at Yale in the photography department, and was at Yale between 86 and 88. And, of course, that had a dramatic effect on my work, and that's when I first started being more interested in using photography as a way of trying to tell a story and also find a photographic language that hovers between film and document. And I think ever since then I've been in one way or another kind of returning back to the same themes over and over again in terms of picture making.
Yeah, I remember the first thing that I'd seen your work for a while, and then I don't know where it was. I think it was at Barbara Gladstone. That was maybe a group show there, and was talking about influences and work. if I remember this correctly, and your work specifically showed reference an image from Close Encounters of, you know, building that wonderful gigantic thing in his living room, and suddenly that something clicked for me about your work and it feeling somewhat like that emotionally as well as aesthetically in some ways.
Well, that's actually, that's a show I curated. I wasn't actually in, but I organized a show called American Standard, named after the toilet manufacturer. But it was a show that tried to find an interconnection between a tradition of American artists or art making that explored the intersection between theatricality and ordinary life. So it was, included artists such as Edward Hopper and Steven Spielberg and Stephen Shore and others. But it was a great opportunity to try to show my influences as an artist. And in some ways, that could be as defining as your pictures yourself, you know. But that's the tradition I locate myself in very much, like that sort of strange intersection between trying to explore the American vernacular and then looking to find a kind of unexpected sense of mystery or beauty through light and color.
Right. And because a lot of students are listening to this as well as artists, what was the kind of trajectory or what led up to your first exhibit after graduate school?
I was in a show. I was recommended to be in a show by Joel Sternfeld, actually, called. It was a large group show at the Museum of Modern Art. It was the first show I was ever in.
Well, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, group show. And that show is called Pleasures and Terrors of Domestic Comfort, and it was organized by Peter Galassi, and. I was just very fortunate that my work fell into that central theme of this show almost exactly. So I wound up with about four or five pictures in that show. And
were those large pictures?
There were large pictures. There were some pictures from my work at Yale, and there were some pictures that I made after. But that was my first entrance into the art world, and then I wound up having an exhibition downtown at the Blum-Hellman warehouse, and then one thing led to another, you know, basically over a long period of time.
And when did you start using actors in your work that were actually well known?
I've only done that on a very limited basis. I mean, I generally use unknown people in my pictures, not even actors. There's just one body of work that I used actors, and that was for a collaboration I did with the New York Times Magazine.
I remember that. That was like a 16-page spread or something.
Yeah.
It's pretty huge, right?
Right, and that was the exception to the rule. And that was I wound up using actors who I felt could accommodate my vision in a certain way. And
you hadn't used actors previous to that?
No. And that was like Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tilda Swinton and Julianne Moore and others. Those were the actors. There's a group of them. But generally, I tend not to use well-known actors or actors at all. I mean, my main connection with film is film production, the use of cinematic techniques in making my pictures, using lighting and other kind of production value.
But it seems almost actors who are used to exactly that value sort of fit the mold.
Yes.
Or it's part of the vernacular, really, there.
Right, exactly. But my main intention, like, in my pictures, is I'm attempting to use light to try to tell a story, like, as a narrative code, because photography is very different from other narrative forms, such as the cinema or literature, and that it doesn't exist in time, so it's one frozen moment. So and also photography is essentially about light. So my ambition is to try to tell a story in a single image using light as a kind of narrative tool in a certain way.
Yeah, that's true. And I think of some of the images that I know of yours, light seems to be, I think of things that seem almost spot lit.
Yeah.
Or it seems clearly that there must be kind of crane type lighting kind of in a cinema,
right. But,
yeah, which is quite dramatic. When you work with actors, how did you reach those actors? I mean, that seems like another sort of interesting but rarefied circle to be in as well.
Well, when we first, I made a list of actors who I thought would be good, and it's really interesting when you first approach their PR people. You know, typically it's a non-response or a no, but there's always a way to like get to them directly. And I think in every single case there was no, once I had a direct contact with the actor, like almost every single one said yes because it was something that interests them.
But it was getting around their agent, essentially.
Yes, basically. And then when we made those pictures, which were all done in a ranch house in Vermont, one of the ground rules of each of them came up alone without agents or press people or hair or makeup, and they would spend a day or two up there. And so I did everything I could to try to kind of demystify or them and trying to make them exist in my world rather than me exist in their world.
That's pretty fascinating. I mean, to me, in terms of how people navigate the world, too, it's great that you got in touch with them.
Right.
Was that through friends? I mean, that's a pretty fascinating connection to make.
There's always ways. You know, there's always, you know, friend of a friend, or there's, you know... Also, I think once you have a certain kind of visibility and you're known for something, I think it makes it easier, you know.
And what happened after that spread? That was amazing. I remember that happening at the time, and even for the Times, I know they've done things like that, but that seemed
very
luxurious.
Yeah, that was the first kind of portfolio at that level. Because
I remember the Starn twins doing one, I don't know when that was, but I guess that was later on.
Well, then there was a lot of actually interest in me making a movie, and there was a lot of discussion of it. I resisted it because I really do think of myself as a photographer exclusively, and then I began my most ambitious body of work to date, which is a large-scale group of pictures called Beneath the Roses, which was about 9 years, 8 years in the making. It was made between 2001 and 2009, essentially. And there were 8 productions in that body of work and hundreds of people involved in terms of production and post-production.
And that took place in New York?
All those pictures were made in Massachusetts.
You were living in New York at the time?
I was living in New York, but I have always had a connection to Massachusetts. I make most of my pictures there. Mm-hmm. And recently, last year, I just bought a church there in Great Barrington. So I lived there pretty much at least half time.
That body of work, then, I mean, I'm in New York then as well. That started right the year of 9/11.
Yeah, it started basically with the spring of 2002. Mm. So yes, it was unlike.
It was right in the wake of that. Then. Did that have an effect on the work? Or?
I think it had effect on everything, on everyone. But I think that oftentimes the connections aren't direct. You know, that it's just, I think artists, there's always a connection between art and life, and artists always are making connections to the larger culture and to the larger world.
So tell me a little bit about that body of work. How did that evolve over that many years? Because that is huge. And,
right.
And instead, it almost seems like, I mean, it came out of you talking about a film, but that sounds almost like cinematic
proportions. It was originally going to be a movie and wound up being a series of photographs. And it's looking back at it now, it's almost hard to believe that I produced all of it.
So it started out actually being a film. You were going to make a film.
I was, the original concept, the title Beneath the Roses, was a kind of treatment for a movie that never was made, thankfully. But it was in almost every way the scale of making a movie, in 8 different productions, basically. There were pictures done on location, pictures done on sound stages. It was quite an endeavor. And in fact, there's a documentary made of the making of Beneath the Roses that just premiered at South by Southwest just a few weeks ago.
So it is a film.
It is a film. Now it's a film. Yeah. The film is actually called Brief Encounters, but it documents the entire production. And so that's just recently come out.
And did that lead to a particular show, that body of work?
That body of work, there were many shows. There were, the first series of shows was 4 years in.
And was that Loring Augustine?
At Loring Augustine, right. But also Gagosian in Los Angeles and White Cube in London. And there was another series of shows 4 years later in 2009. And now there's a travel and retrospective of that show, you know, traveling through Europe.
So they weren't intended necessarily to all be exhibited together? I mean, I'm trying to understand just the...
So there's a book that shows all the pictures, has all the pictures. And there was, after 4 years, I felt like I was ready to show, do the first part of the, show the first part of the work. Mm. And then I knew it wasn't complete, so then I finished the cycle. Hmm. And now that's done. Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And by completing the cycle, what does that mean? What to you meant it was done? Was it a certain amount of images or a certain amount of...
Just when I knew it was finished, it's hard to describe, but I knew... You know, I mean, what the artist always has to have an understanding of when something's finished or something's complete. And sometimes it's really scary to know because it's something you know how to do. And then you have to challenge yourself and rethink things when something's complete. You know?
This was a multi-year project, so that's, I mean, particularly sort of poignant with this kind of issue. Could it have stopped 3 years earlier? Or
could it?
You know, I mean, and you talked about it as the most ambitious thing, so there still is a certain amount or a completion in terms of your exploration of what you're doing there?
I just had that intuition that it was over when it was over, or before it was over. I knew there were other pictures to make. Mm-hmm. But when it was over, I absolutely knew it was finished, you know, Beneath the Roses. And I don't think I will ever attempt something on that scale again. And I feel like I've done it in terms of that kind of picture making.
So then what's next?
Well, then after that, I did a body of work that was a complete change, dramatic change, in a group of pictures called Sanctuary, which were small black and white pictures made on the back lot of Cinecittà Studios in Rome, which were all the collapsed sets.
Wow, is that where, like, Fellini films were shot or something?
Sort of a graveyard of like collapsed old sets of Rome and everything. Those pictures were done in complete kind of contrast to my previous pictures. They were just done in black and white, all digital, small format, no people.
And previously that everything's been filmed?
Yes. Film, but digital prints, but this was entirely digital. And it was the first time I ever worked outside of this country. So there was a lot of ways that it challenged me. And that was completed a few years ago, and now I'm just starting work on a new body of pictures.
And you continue to teach. I mean, it sounds like many artists are teaching to supplement their careers. I would imagine you don't need to do that anymore, but you want to teach, or what is it?
I feel a great, profound need to teach. I feel, for many reasons, I think firstly it's a really always great to be in connection or in touch with the next generation of artists coming up. That's always important. It keeps you vital, it keeps you fresh, and even like asking them what movies they've seen or what music they listen to. And then the main thing I do are these weekly critiques with other faculty, and I think it's a privileged forum where you really talk about pictures in ways that you don't in other in other contexts. And so I think I will always teach, and I think it's, and I don't really see it as being that distinct from what I do as an artist. And I never approach it as an academic. I at least approach teaching as an artist. So,
well, that's really interesting. I mean, I think maybe we should talk a little bit about that, and towards the end of this talk, which is happening. Artists go to graduate school.
Right.
You know, this is something that's obviously good for most. Mm-hmm. But it's contentious. Some people feel that why do artists go to graduate school? Must they go to graduate school? Is it good for them? I've seen artists even give lectures here. I think it was Robert Grosvenor gave a lecture not long ago who said he felt that an MFA was a horrible thing to get, and it messed up all his assistants. And you know, I mean, I don't know what axe he had to grind, but I mean, I'm talking about the kind of, you're coming from a very different perspective. You're an artist that's working in the world, that's succeeding in the world. The students for you sounds like are inspiring and part of the conversation. That's not always the case with professors, don't you think?
I totally agree. The most important thing about going to school, and I think one of the central reasons that I feel it's important, is there's a few things, but one is it's the community that you enter into. It's the other artists in the program. And when it's a school like Yale, there's a long history and tradition, and it does help the artists feel like they're part of something larger, and they are part of something larger. Mm-hmm. I'm still in contact with people who I went to school here as a graduate student, and I feel there's a certain kind of link that we have, a sense of connection. And so I think that's one of the most important reasons to go to graduate school. And I mean, obviously, unlike other professional schools, there's no guarantee of anything, but it does help you establish the sense that you're not alone in this world, and that there is a larger world that you feel connected to.
And does it also establish a kind of conversation, a dialogue? I mean,
yes.
This notion of your work being talked about, or is it talked about or not talked about?
It's all part of it. And I would also say, when you're in your 20s, that's when you sort of define yourself as an artist in a certain way. And in this, and you continue over the course of your lifetime to go back to those central defining parameters that you created when you were in your 20s.
Hmm.
In graduate school, for me, I keep circling back to this, the same arguments in a certain way. So there is this period where you're defined as an artist, and that what you do for the rest of your life is a kind of revision or reinvention of those central kind of influences.
A poet once told me, Daniel Berrigan, that he is a published poet and an activist, and he once said to me, I don't think it's too good to be in an institution too long because it's a kind of cozy environment for the teacher. The students admire the teacher. The teacher acknowledges that admiration, and he says it's not quite like the edge that there is in the world outside of the university. Now, maybe you're in a different position because you're already working in that world,
I think that's part, certainly those issues exist, and I think that there is, you know, periods of transition in any school, and mm-hmm. I feel like the art school in many ways is in one of those now, and that's just certain things to be aware of, and, you know, and the important thing is to continue to challenge yourself in different ways.
In closing, I mean, artists are listening to this and students, what is it that you think would help them upon graduating or to see whether it's graduate school or undergraduate school? Part of, I think, everyone's struggle, and you see it everywhere, is oftentimes people get involved in jobs or working or paying rent in New York, and their art career struggles enormously for a long time, forever, or for a short time. How you have any idea of how to manage that, or what to say to speak to that? Because I know a lot of people are graduating and they're wondering just like where to go. It's the market isn't talked about in school, right?
I think the one fundamental advice I would give any young artist is to trust their vision, because that's the thing that's really in the end the only thing they have is their particular view of the world, and do anything you can to guard that and nurture that, and trust that in a certain sense, and then everything else, of course, it's a struggle and it's a fight, and there's always, particularly in your early years, you have to figure out ways to survive and everything. But if you can keep that vision alive and believe in it, that it will grow in a certain way and affect people.
You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.